Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. All month long, we've been speaking with authors, journalists, and public figures about their memories of President Kennedy and the dark Dallas day when he was assassinated. Of course, JFK's death cut short a vibrant life and an unfinished presidency. It also opened the door to a half century of speculation about what happened in Dealey Plaza and what might have been in the White House. Author and journalist Dean Owen has gathered many such remembrances in his new book, November 22, 1963, Reflections on the Life, Assassination, and Legacy of John F. Kennedy, which is published by Skyhorse. And Dean Owen, welcome to the Roundtable.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you very much.
In your own professional life, you cite that crazy week in Dallas as the reason you went into the work that you did. So what was the meaning of those few days for you?
Ian, those who weren't alive or of age, say, 5 or 10 in 1963, can't fathom what it was like. The entire country stopped. Stores closed. People stayed home or went to their other friends' homes to watch television. Sports events were canceled. There were no commercials on television for 3 days after the assassination. It was extraordinary. I was in the second grade in a small city in the Bay Area of Northern California. And of course, I didn't believe it when the older sister of a friend of mine told me that the president had been shot. I went home from school later that day, and yes, in front of the television were my mother and grandmother crying. And I was deeply moved by them, but also what I was watching, and garnered everything I could. I read, I watched television. It was an extraordinary 3.5 days that truly changed my life and was the catalyst for my fascination, my wife of 31 years would say obsession, with how the media shape public opinion.
Going back to Dallas 1963, as you mentioned, you know, people were kind of glued to the TV. It was that first major TV news moment. What kind of impact on public opinion do you think, you know, men like Walter Cronkite and the rest had in those very surprising and upsetting few days?
Well, I think in many ways, Ian, television news came of age that weekend. In my book, Tom Brokaw comments about how the television was the centrifuge for the entire country. People drew from it in some fashion. This was a time where people were shocked, horrified, traumatized, and also fascinated. People remember, of course, where they were when they heard the news, if you're 60 or older now. If you're between 20 and 60, you remember where you were when you heard the news about the September 11th attacks. Again, a sudden, traumatic, unexpected event leaves indelible images in our minds and in our psyches. And for me, a 7-year-old boy, very much of an impressionable age, I was absolutely captivated. I was fascinated. And of course, like many Americans, I was sitting in front of my television that Sunday morning, the 24th, and was watching NBC, which was the only station of the three broadcast networks then, that carried the shooting of Lee Harvey Oswald live on television. I saw that live, and I thought to myself, oh my gosh, this isn't a fake event. This really happened. This man, who was accused of killing the president, was just shot live in front of me. I will never forget it.
There's also tremendous irony here because I'm thinking of modern events like the assassination of Benazir Bhutto, maybe, or a lot of stuff that's happened in the Arab Spring, where there's almost too many angles and too much video and so many tweets and things to narrow down to an essential truth. In this case, of course, the Zapruder film, which came out very much later showing the assassination, and as you mentioned, the One Network showing what happened with Lee Harvey Oswald and Jack Ruby, it definitely muddies the waters when we have so many angles to look at. But on the other hand, we would have more answers if there had been more footage.
Precisely, Ian. If this were to occur now, there would, of course, be video feeds on YouTube within 90 seconds. We would be inundated with video, with photographs, with people's reflections. It was an entirely different world then from a communication standpoint. And yet those compelling images we have, either from the Zapruder film or from other sources, again, the Pulitzer Prize-winning image of Ruby shooting Oswald, the incredible image of John Kennedy Jr. Near his father's casket and giving the salute. Those are iconic images of the 20th century. In fact, that weekend, interestingly enough, with the Oswald shooting, with the salute by John Jr., with, of course, the swearing-in of Lyndon Johnson, with the widow right next to him on one side and his wife, Lady Bird Johnson, on his right, three or four iconic images of the 20th century were shot within a 2 or 3 day period. It's fascinating.
So as you've gone around and gathered the remembrances of all of the people, journalists, staffers, family, who remember the assassination and the days afterward, did you find that those pictures, as you mentioned, influenced their own memories of those days?
Oh, definitely, yes. One of the most interesting interviews I have that is in the book is from a gentleman who worked for Life magazine at the time by the name of Richard Stolle. Richard now lives in New Mexico, but at the time he was a Life photo editor based in Los Angeles. As soon as he heard about the shooting of President Kennedy, he got on the first plane he could to Dallas and was the one who negotiated the rights to the Zapruder film for Life. He had a fascinating story about watching the film, about how he acquired the images, and how that played into how Life used those in a very respectful way. If you go back to the magazine from that weekend, you'll see that they intentionally omitted frame 313, the traumatic image of the brains and blood erupting from Kennedy's head, just out of deference to the family. Today, that would be entirely different. We would see that graphic image everywhere on the news that night, again, on YouTube, etc. Just to give you some perspective, there are 100 hours of YouTube video posted every minute. It's extraordinary how much we are inundated. We've gone from the age of information to the age of information overload in just a few years.
Let's talk a little bit more about how you actually went around and found all of these people to speak with. It's a wide list, and a lot of them have similar themes of feeling shock and a sense that there was a lot of unfinished business here.
Oh, very much so. I intentionally sought out a wide range of people, some very famous people. Billy Graham is in the book, the priest who administered last rites to John Kennedy. His reflections are in the book. Walter Mondale, John Lewis, the famous congressman from Georgia who was one of the civil rights leaders, Julian Bond, Nicholas Katzenbach, the former attorney general who worked both for Lyndon Johnson and for John Kennedy. And then people who are not well-known, but who had interesting, fascinating, or poignant encounters with John Kennedy. There is one person who ever lived who knew both John Kennedy and Lee Harvey Oswald. She lives in Boston. I had dinner with her twice. Her name is Priscilla Johnson McMillan. I also had the opportunity to interview a second-year pediatric resident who in 1963 happened to be in the room when John F. Kennedy Jr. was born, not breathing, and was the one who saved his life because the doctor who delivered the child, as well as the chief of anesthesiology at Georgetown Hospital, they both panicked. And one of my real coups, I think, is the heart and lung specialist from the Boston area named Dr. William Bernhard, who worked for 30 hours to try and save the life of the Kennedy second son, Patrick Bouvier Kennedy, who was born in August of 1963. So I sought out intentionally a wide range of people to get a wide range of different views about this man, not just about his death, but about what he was like before he died, staff members, friends, people who knew him personally, etc., including the man who introduced John Kennedy to Jacqueline Bouvier, and then, of course, people to reflect on what is his legacy 50 years later. And I think, like most of your listeners, I'm sure that most people think that he had a very mixed legacy. His presidency, of course, was cut short. He had the debacle of the Bay of Pigs in 1961. later, of course, the success without going to war with the Soviets over the Cuban Missile Crisis, of course, as and in many ways, as the title of Robert Dallek's book, he had an unfinished life. We'll never know what a second Kennedy term might have been. We'll never know whether he would have won a second term. One of the people whose reflections are in the book is the son of Barry Goldwater, the man who probably was going to be running against John Kennedy in 1964.
Yeah, and he says that they joked about running against each other and going from city to city together and having debates alongside each other.
Exactly. And I think they would have done that. And as Mr. Goldwater says, it would have set a higher bar than what we have today. And it's too bad that did not occur. I think in large part because both of those men had a fairly high degree of self-confidence and self-assurance. And regrettably, I truly believe that Kennedy's two predecessors, Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon, certainly did not.
Let's go back a bit and talk about that one woman who knew both the president and his assassin. How did she know both of them?
Very interesting. Priscilla Johnson McMillan worked for John Kennedy as a researcher shortly after Kennedy took office in the Senate in 1953, and then saw him socially throughout the 1950s until she moved to Moscow to work as a journalist in 1958. In 1959 or 60, her boss in Moscow came to her and said, there's a 20-year-old Marine here from Texas who wants to defect to the Soviet Union. It might make an interesting feature story. He won't talk to me, but he might talk to you because you're a woman. Sure enough, Priscilla sat down that night for 6 hours and interviewed Lee Harvey Oswald. Did not hear from either man again or hear of them again until November 22nd, 1963. She was walking through Cambridge, Massachusetts, which is where she still lives, and heard from a owner of a florist that the man that they had arrested for shooting the president was a man named Lee Harvey Oswald. And her first gasp was, "Oh my gosh, I know that boy." She later befriended Oswald's widow and wrote a compelling book called Marina and Lee, truly getting into the minds of both individuals as much as she possibly could, with, of course, one of them deceased, and wrote a fascinating book about their marriage and their relationship prior to meeting in Minsk in Russia in 1961. And then after they both came to the U.S., he, of course, returning to Dallas and his wife coming, of course, for the first time. But and then the book, of course, just been reissued for the 50th anniversary of the assassination. A fascinating woman, very sharp, very articulate, a real joy to be with her.
There was a lot of Kennedy stuff going on right now around the 50th anniversary, of course.
Yeah.
One of the more popular hits on our website was from one of the authors who contends that LBJ was actually behind the killing. And almost as much attention has been paid to forensics and Lee Harvey Oswald, even more than JFK himself. And I was thinking, reading your book, about how even the film JFK is not about JFK at all. It's about theories about which bullet went where in the end. So I wonder if you feel, obviously, this assassination has just changed the legacy for the president in a way that it hasn't for any other ex-presidents, certainly of the last 100 years.
Correct. Yes. Yes, exactly. I purposely did not ask any questions about either John Kennedy's sex life or assassination conspiracy theories of those whom I interviewed. I thought then, and still do, that there have been more than enough words written about both topics. And frankly, I wasn't going to change anyone's mind on either issue. Didn't want to touch it, and glad I didn't, frankly, because I think my book stands out as something different that people can read, pick up here and there. Most of the reflections are only a few pages in length, and also people have the opportunity to read a wide range of views, people who liked him, people who didn't, people who worked for him, people who agreed with his policies. Again, I wanted conservatives and liberals, Democrats, Republicans, and people from all walks of life who aren't political to give me their thoughts on who this man was. All but a few, all but two or three people who are in the book met him, knew him, or as I said earlier, had fascinating, interesting, or poignant encounters.
You know, when you're working on a project like this, anytime you're talking about 50th anniversaries, there has to be a certain amount of urgency on your end to get all of these remembrances down. Some of them had been published earlier, but many weren't, and you know, no one's getting any younger, right?
Yes, exactly. In fact, 10 people since I've interviewed them have passed away, including the woman who wrote the foreword, Helen Thomas. The woman who covered 10 presidents, she wrote the foreword and was just fascinated, enthralled by far. John Kennedy was her favorite of the 10 presidents whom she covered. Again, personal friends who also had some interesting backgrounds. Benjamin Bradley, who was the editor of the Washington Post. As I mentioned, Billy Graham. Cliff Robertson, the actor who portrayed Kennedy in the film PT-109, that was that came out just before Kennedy's assassination. The White House social secretary and assistant to Mrs. Kennedy, Letitia Baldridge. Again, just a wide range of people and their, I think, very interesting comments, observations, reflections, insights into a man whose legacy continues today. And part of his legacy and part of the fascination, I think, is the assassination. We'll never know what would have happened.
Yeah. How did your summation of him change, if it did at all, over the course of the interviews you did with his confidants?
I learned a couple of things about him. I learned, of course, you know, witty, charismatic, those are easy observations to make when you watch his speeches, when you watch his press conferences, etc. He was in many ways also very deeply flawed, very concerned with history, how history was going to judge his administration. And how he would be viewed over the next 30, 40, 50, even 100 years. And I think because of what happened, people will still be talking about this man in 50 years from now, 100 years from now, because he was so interesting. The first president born in the 20th century, by far more charismatic than most other presidents, and certainly leading the country at a time in the height of the Cold War, with, of course, that difficult meeting with Khrushchev in 1961 in Vienna. So he led the country at an interesting time. He inspired many young people to join the newly formed Peace Corps under his administration. In fact, one of the people who was in the book was inspired to go into public service because of that famous "Ask Not" remark from Kennedy's inaugural address.
Optics were huge for Kennedy, and he certainly was the first television president in many ways. How do you think his influence is felt on politicians in modern use of media?
Oh, extraordinary. He set the tone. He set a new high bar for how candidates, not just at the presidential level, but throughout the federal level, the state level, the local level, how candidates present their views, how candidates relate to the public changed under John Kennedy. As you probably know, during Eisenhower's administration, there were no live press conferences. They were taped, they were edited, and then they were allowed to be shown. Kennedy was the first one to allow this to be shown live. And I think that was part of the fascination with him. No one had ever done this before. He was a young man. He was 43 when he was elected, the second youngest president to take office and the youngest ever elected, Theodore Roosevelt, after the assassination of McKinley in 1901, was actually the youngest president ever to take office. But Kennedy had this stunningly beautiful wife, two gorgeous children. His death was a death in the family. There was the tragedy of September 11th, when 2,000 people died. But outside of family and friends, no one knew who they were. In 1963, this was a death in the family. This young, charismatic president gunned down at at the peak of his career.
We've been speaking with Dean Owen, the author of November 22, 1963, Reflections on the Life, Assassination, and Legacy of John F. Kennedy, and the book is out from Skyhorse Publishing. Dean Owen, thank you so much for sharing your views on the president and also for a great read.
Ian, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.